Hello, I'm Brian Kennedy, Director of the Hood Museum of Art. Welcome to the Baker Berry Library Reserve Corridor and the audio tour of the Mexican muralist José Clemente Orozco's Epic of American Civilization. This is one of the greatest treasures of the Hood Museum of Art and Dartmouth College's collection. The Epic of American Civilization was painted at Dartmouth by Orozco between 1932 and 1934. Covering the history of the Americas from the migration of the Aztecs into central Mexico to the development of our modern industrialized society, the mural comprises 24 individual panels or scenes. In the 75 years since it was presented, the Epic of American Civilization has had a profound influence on countless artists and scholars, tens of thousands of students and faculty, and visitors from all parts of the globe. Mary Coffey, Assistant Professor of North American and Latin American Art at Dartmouth College, will host our tour, which begins with the test panel that Orozco painted in the hallway at the northwest corner of the reserve corridor. Professor Coffey will guide you through the entire mural cycle. Please pause your player when she indicates that it's time to move on to the next panel. Enjoy your tour.
I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Mary Coffey, and I'm an assistant professor of art history at Dartmouth College. I like to begin here because this is where Orozco began, with this test panel. Orozco was invited to Dartmouth to teach the art students the technique of fresco, and this is the panel that he executed. And it was while working on this panel and lecturing on the technique of fresco that he began to think about the possibility of the larger commission that we see in the Baker Reserve Corridor. This mural, called Man Released from the Mechanistic, represents the individual moving out of or being released from the mechanistic world that is represented along the bottom of the image. And even though it's a single image, it encapsulates one of the main themes of the major cycle in the reserve corridor, and that is the theme of human beings and individuals releasing themselves from the mechanistic, overly industrialized modern world. There are two things I want to point out about this mural that are important in Orozco's art. The first is his emphasis on the individual. Here we see that man is represented by the striving individual, the individual who rises up out of the chaos depicted at the bottom of the composition. The other thing that's important to note here is Orozco's interest in the eyes and the hands. You'll note in the larger cycle that when he depicts the human figure, he gives a lot of emphasis to the hands and to the eyes. For Orozco, the hands refer to the human capacity to make and to build and to create, and the eyes refer to intellection and insight. So these are two important iconographic motifs throughout the mural. As we walk back into the reserve corridor, we're going to walk toward the reserve desk and stop in front of the panel called The Prophecy. So here we are in the reserve room at Dartmouth College, and we're stopping for a minute here so that we can talk about the way that Orozco uses the architecture to construct his epic of American civilization. The room, when Orozco arrived, looked very much as it looks right now in terms of its architectural structure, and he decided to use the division at the reserve desk creatively to establish a distinction between the ancient and the modern Americas. The mural begins with the panel Ancient Migration, and then it works all the way around the room. When we meet the reserve desk, it functions as a rupture within the narrative, a rupture that coincides with the Spanish conquest, which marks the end of ancient civilization and the beginning of modern civilization. Orozco's story of America, or his epic of American civilization, is different than what would have been the typical story of American civilization in the 1930s. A U.S. version of American civilization would begin with the arrival of the Pilgrims in New England and move west. It would typically be structured as a progressive narrative, culturally progressive and technologically progressive toward the modern moment. Orozco takes a hemispheric perspective. That is, he tells the history of America from the vantage point of its indigenous civilizations, and the modern moment or the modern world is inaugurated by Cortés's arrival, Cortés's conquest of the Americas. This, however, it should not be understood as a nationalist narrative. That is, he is telling us the story of the Americas from a Mexican perspective. However, he was rabidly anti-nationalist, and his anti-nationalism is visible throughout the murals. For Orozco, this is a story of civilization more broadly, and his conception of civilization is cyclical rather than linear, narrative, or progressive. And he uses the architecture of the room to establish these points of references or these mirrorings between the ancient and the modern world to set up the theme of cycles of history. The most obvious place to see this is in the ways in which ancient human migration, the far left of this wall, mirrors the modern migration of the spirit at the far end of the corridor. Likewise, ancient human sacrifice shown here mirrors the modern human sacrifice at the far end of the corridor. So Orozco is setting up analogies across time and space rather than arguing that history is progressive and moves from a state of darkness into a state of enlightenment. Now, before we go through the cycle in chronological order, I'd like to start in front of the panel titled The Prophecy, just next to the reserve desk in this side of the room. We're beginning out of sequence. This is not the first image in the mural cycle, but it is the first image that Orozco painted, and that's why I like to start here. Orozco started with this panel, and then he left for an extended trip to Europe. It was the first time he'd been to Europe. He knew European art very well, but he'd actually never been to Europe. He'd never seen the great Renaissance frescoes that were so influential on his colleagues. He'd not seen a lot of the contemporary modern art that was also influential in the development of his style in person. So this trip had a profound impact on him stylistically and in terms of how he developed as a painter of monumental public art. And we can see the transition in this juxtaposition here between the panel titled The Prophecy and the panel titled The Departure of Quetzalcoatl. You can see in the Prophecy panel, he's working very much as an easel painter. He's using very small brushes, very small brushwork. The image itself is very three-dimensional. That is, he's attempting to use the technique of fresco as he would oil paint. There's a lot of three-dimensionality, the use of shading and modeling to get a kind of meticulous treatment of the figure and the architectural elements. If you compare that with the panel just to the left, we see after he returns from Europe, his brushwork really opens up. He becomes a much more monumental and expressive painter. That is, he uses line and color in an expressive way as vehicles of expression in and of themselves, rather than subordinating the brush stroke or the color or the line to a preconceived idea of the composition or figure. This is characteristic of expressionistic art. That is, an art form that emphasizes the more subjective rather than an objective representation of the figure or subject matter. And artists working in the expressionist mode use a very liberated sense of color, line, and form. And we can see that the mural cycle from this point forward becomes very expressionistic, both in the artist's use of color and in the way that he treats the figure. And it also becomes much more monumental. That is, the figures become much larger, the compositions become much more open, and we can actually see passages like the expressive brushwork here, where we see the serpents, a very open, loose, almost informal brushwork. Now I'd like to walk over to the far end of the west wing so that we can look at the first two panels in the mural cycle and talk about the narrative that he's developing across the architectural space. The mural begins here with the first panel called Ancient Migration. And what this refers to is the migration of peoples from what is currently the southwestern part of the United States into the Valley of Mexico. It's a reference to the Aztec prophecy of the migration of peoples into the Central Valley of Mexico, where they built the great Aztec empire, Tenochtitlan. It also refers in general to the migration of peoples across the continent. And Orozco uses the theme of migration and the unified movement of these bodies to direct our bodies around the mural. That is, these figures all face right, and through the movement and the thrust of their figures, they suggest that we too should move right. As we move on then to the next panel, we see a scene of human sacrifice, a ritual practice that is characteristic of most Mesoamerican civilizations, and something that Orozco had a very negative attitude about. And most people from his time period viewed Aztec sacrifice as a barbaric ritual and something that was a negative a sign of their civilization. One thing I want to point out here at the Ancient Human Sacrifice panel is the way in which Orozco uses a very shallow sense of space. All of the figures are pushed up toward the front of the picture plane, creating a lack of depth in the composition, and this creates a sense of claustrophobia as we're forced to sort of confront these figures very close up. Likewise, there's a real lack of individuality here, as the individual's faces are all masked and the individual is being sacrificed for the society. The figure presiding over these priests who are participating in the ritual act of sacrifice is a vague reference to a series of Aztec gods, but in particular it picks up the form of the goddess Cuatlique, a goddess that in the Aztec pantheon represents both the positive and negative, birth and death, war and creation, all of these forces caught up together. But Orozco represents her really as a kind of demonic god presiding over what he views as a demonic ritual or a barbaric ritual. So these two panels, while referring to the origins of ancient civilization, characterize ancient civilization at its origins, very barbaric, very brute, lacking the kind of civilization and enlightenment that Quetzalcoatl brings with his arrival in the next panel. The entire sequence of murals on the north wall deal with the arrival of Quetzalcoatl, the great white god, bearded white god, who brings into being an enlightened or golden age, an ancient golden age. One thing I want to point out is that Orozco frames the series of panels on this wall with two images of warriors. On the far left of the wall, we see the Aztec warriors in various eagle and jaguar costumes, and they face right. At the far right-hand end of the wall, we see the conquistadors with their horses and their cross, and they face left. These two groupings of warriors represent the confrontation, the coming confrontation between the ancient civilization under Quetzalcoatl and the arrival of Cortes with the Spanish conquest. And they frame this enlightened period in which Quetzalcoatl arrives and civilization prospers, and then he is rejected by his people, which we're seeing at the far end of the wall. In the arrival panel here, we see that Quetzalcoatl is depicted as a white god. Orozco is basing his representation of Quetzalcoatl on ancient descriptions of him as a white-bearded god and using the image of God the Father from Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel as a kind of prototype for that image. You can see that Orozco emphasizes his powerful hands and his bright, sort of vivid blue eyes. He is a sort of ferocious figure, but a figure who brings enlightenment and culture and civilization to the ancient world. Orozco locates his arrival in the ancient city of Teotihuacan, which we can see represented here in the great pyramids of the sun and moon. This was an abandoned Toltecan city that the Aztecs named the place of the gods and nominated as the sort of origins for their civilization. So Orozco uses that Aztec story to describe Quetzalcoatl's arrival, and we see arrayed behind him a series of pagan gods associated with the Aztec pantheon who are being supplanted and subsumed by the singular figure of Quetzalcoatl as an emblem of a kind of monotheistic system that brings about peace, prosperity, and enlightenment. One of the things that we can see right away in this panel is that Orozco is using a linear or rational perspectival system. That is, this wall that is under construction recedes toward a single vanishing point that meets somewhere at the intersection of the pyramids of the sun and the moon, and then our eye rises up from that into the monumental figure of Quetzalcoatl. This use of rational, linear, perspectival space is a key in Orozco's mural. Whenever you see this kind of rational, recessional space, Orozco is depicting a balanced society in order, a positive rendering of society. When he uses a more cubist or shallow sense of space, he's depicting society in a very negative way. We know that this is a more positive rendering of society because rather than seeing images of sacrifice and warfare, we see figures at rest, figures engaged in some kind of productive dialogue or teaching exercise, and figures involved in some kind of productive activity. So in the foreground of the arrival of Quetzalcoatl, we see references to positive forms of human activity. These positive forms then are elaborated in the next two panels, where we see the flourishing of agriculture during this great golden age, the development of the arts, shown here with a monumental figure shown in profile, carving relief sculptures on monoliths, And this figure here, who's referred to as the astronomer, referring to the astronomical accomplishments of the ancient world. So we have here three emblems of a society at its height, at its pinnacle of the Golden Age. However, this society does not last. In the final scene of the ancient Golden Age, Orozco shows the people rejecting the enlightenment of Quetzalcoatl, and he dramatizes this rejection by once again showing us a mass of figures like we saw in the ancient migration panel, shown leaning backwards as though they are regressing back toward a more primitive state, rejecting Quetzalcoatl's enlightenment, and Quetzalcoatl's division or rejection by his people is dramatized by this cleft in the composition that literally separates him from the mass, and he is shown pointing dramatically toward his prophecy. The story goes that as Quetzalcoatl was rejected by his people, he prophesied his return, at which point he would destroy the civilization he had helped to build. So Orozco takes that prophecy and uses that theme of prophecy throughout the mural to talk about the building and destruction of civilizations. So it's Quetzalcoatl's prophecy that is enacted when Cortez arrives. And of course, for a long time, scholars believed that the Aztecs viewed Cortez as the return of Quetzalcoatl because he was a white-bearded figure on horseback. That belief is no longer current, but when Orozco was painting these murals, that certainly would have been one of the ways that the conquest was understood. So he uses that theme, that idea of Quetzalcoatl's return in the figure of Cortez in the mural here. And this, of course, marks the rupture in the narrative, the end of the ancient world, the end of the ancient civilization, and the beginning of the modern world. And that rupture, of course, is dramatized by the rupture of the reserve desk that breaks the space in two. Before we walk into the east wing of the corridor, I want to stop for one second and talk about these depictions of Native Northwest Coast totem poles. We'll see when we go on the other side of the reserve desk that Orozco makes an analogy between these totem poles and what he calls modern machine totems. These images here are references to, of course, Native Northwest Coast totem poles, but for Orozco, they represented a kind of primitive fetish. He didn't understand much about Native Northwest Coast cultures, but he viewed these as idolatry or a form of idolatry that he could then equate with modern forms of idolatry, that is, the worship of machines, technology, and a kind of Western civilization that is always represented in his murals as a Greek column. I want to also talk a bit about the palette, because you'll see here that the palette in the totem poles is very bright, using very strident primary colors, and you'll note that if you look back toward the entrance of the west wing, that the little panel above the doors called Snakes and Spears also uses this very bright palette. These are images that Orozco painted at the end of the cycle, so that in part accounts for the difference in the color scheme that's being used in these panels and the larger panels associated with the west wing of the corridor. You'll note when we go into the east wing that the palette becomes more and more strident, brighter and brighter, as Orozco moves away from this expressionistic style into a kind of expressionistic caricature. And that is why we're seeing these coloristic differences. He was not interested in unifying the mural coloristically, stylistically, or even in terms of the kinds of artistic references that he was borrowing. Orozco works in juxtaposition rather than in a kind of narrative continuity or a narrative style like Diego Rivera's. He's interested in placing things next to one another that aren't necessarily the same in order to force the viewer to synthesize the two images and to come up with his or her own idea about what they're supposed to think about or what the murals are about, rather than telling the viewer what they're supposed to think. So let's walk on to the other side of the corridor into the east wing. So the east wing of the reserve corridor begins with the conquest, and here we see the arrival of Cortez accompanied by Catholic missionaries, and with Cortez we see the destruction of the ancient world, enacting Quetzalcoatl's prophecy that he would return and destroy the world that he had helped to create. This is a panel where we can really see Orozco using modernist compositional devices, in particular the cubist rupturing of pictorial space. The mural is very densely layered with imagery. It goes all the way up to the top of the wall. Therefore, it has a very high horizon line. There is no rational depiction of recessional space in the mural. For instance, if we look at this rectangular boulder that leads the eye into the figure of the missionary, it is immediately interrupted by the vertical figure of the missionary, and then the sense of recessional space ends there. These are cubist devices that he knew as a modernist artist, and he employs them always when he's depicting a society in a negative or critical way. That is the fragmentation of space, the rupturing of space that cubist artists pioneered for him are used as a signifier for the fragmentation of society, the destruction of society, and the bringing about of visual chaos. Obviously, Cortes is a monumental figure. He becomes a sort of anti-heroic counterpart to Quetzalcoatl at the beginning of the cycle in the other room. He is shown as an armored, heavily armored conquistador with his long sword here, and he looks impassively upon this landscape of destruction. Next to him, we see a monk with his eyes closed, planting a gangrenous cross in this pile of rubble, and this refers, of course, to the missionary practice of the conquest, that is, the spiritual conquest that accompanied the military conquest. And we'll see another famous Orozco motif, that is the use of fire. The fires in his murals always represent a kind of catharsis, a destruction and a renewal. And here, this also refers to the story that Cortes had burnt his own ships to keep his men from returning after they arrived in the New World. So in this sea of flames where his boats are going up in fire, we see the destruction of the ancient world. And to Cortes's left, or our right, we see a pile of human bodies depicted in very warm flesh tones as a contrast to the sort of militaristic, hyper-cool colors that he uses for Cortes's body. These figures are sort of blending into a mass and then sort of being twisted and connected into the next panel, as if the machine imagery from the next panel are actually grinding them up. In this way, Orozco makes a connection between the conquest, that is the vehicle that brought Western civilization and industrial or technological know-how to the New World, and the emergence or the development of a technological modern world, a world of machines. Before we look at the machine panel, we should just note the modern machine totems that frame the archway as we are looking back toward the west wing. These here are Orozco's modern machine totems. You see on the right a sort of recording machine piled up in technological stuff superimposed over the image of a Greek column, and on the left we see what look like rifle components or militarized weapons superimposed over a column there. These are the equivalents of the ancient totems on the other side of the reserve desk, and they establish the close connection for Orozco between modernity, mechanization, and a kind of technologized war. The next panel after Cortes and the cross represents a jump in time from the conquest into the modern world, and for Orozco, the modern world is a world wherein technology has run amok. Unlike Rivera, his counterpart, who viewed technology as a vehicle for social revolution and social equality, Orozco is very pessimistic about the machine, very pessimistic about industry, and we see that pessimism in this panel. Once again, he's using these cubist spatial devices to create a mechanized landscape in which there is no human presence. This is a machine landscape in which nature has been completely obliterated. We don't see productive machinery. None of these machines make sense. None of the iconography refers to any particular kind of machine. We just see vague references to grain silos, to chemical silos, and to cogwheels and various machine parts all mixed together to create a menacing, very steely landscape. This is the panel then that mediates between the conquest and the two panels dedicated to the Americas, the two Americas, Anglo-America and Hispano-America. And it's important to note that Orozco connects Anglo-America to the machine because, of course, in the 1930s, the United States was the most technologically advanced nation and very closely associated with the idea of industrialization and mechanization. Orozco's vision of Anglo-America is contrasted with his vision of Hispano-America. Both panels contain negative and positive commentary on the two Americas. Orozco admired what he called Anglo-America because of its political stability. He recognized that the United States, compared to Mexico, for instance, had had a longer history of political stability, and he attributed that to the consensus society that America is predicated on. And he represents that kind of consensus with a highly regimented composition of figures shown in rows and all of the community circulating around what appears to be a town meeting. Orozco frames the image with an image of a barn and a schoolhouse, and we have here a tall schoolmarm surrounded by zombie-like children. On the one hand, he's acknowledging universal education and the role of education in American stability and notions of democracy. On the other hand, he's indicting American education or American society for being highly consensus-based and lacking a kind of individuality or creativity. So all the children look like zombies, all the people look like they're sleepwalking, and they have a kind of almost creepy appearance, as if they seem to be super unified. The grouping of men in the front, too, are all wearing the kind of characteristic gray flannel suit of the businessman. This is sort of a nascent critique of what would be called the organization man, or this kind of corporate culture. Orozco has been in the lower foreground this beautiful passage of wheat as a representation of the agrarian base of the American economy. And this is all contrasted then with Hispano-America, which is depicted as a highly unstable space, as a chaotic space swirling through cycles of corruption and destruction, and a society or a part of the Americas that are rooted in a kind of mineral wealth represented by the piling of gold coins at the base of Hispano-America. So if Anglo-America is this highly regimented society wherein people come together at the town meeting to work out their differences and make decisions about their laws, Hispano-America is organized around the principle of the warrior, the great revolutionary figure who stands at the heart of the composition, and around him are an array of corrupt figures responsible for the ongoing cycles of destruction that are characteristic of Mexican history and parts of Latin America. To his left, we see international businessmen struggling over a huge bag of coins, and behind them a whole slew of generals, all of them greedily grabbing for Mexico's or Hispano-America's natural resources and wealth. Behind them, at the very top of the composition, we see the toppling of the old order, a reference to the destruction of Porfirian Mexico and the emergence of post-revolutionary Mexico after the revolution of 1910. On the other side of the warrior, we see representations of foreign generals, and behind them, masked bourgeois figures also struggling and fighting over Mexico's mineral wealth. The foreign general is poised, ready to assassinate the warrior, and in this way, Orozco is referencing both the internal and external forms of corruption and exploitation that characterize Mexico's history. Behind the warrior, he shows the beginning of two new modern skyscrapers, both of which have been left incomplete, both of which seem to be in a state of decomposition. For Orozco, this is a criticism of Hispano-America, an argument that even as they topple the old order in an attempt to build a new society, that the new society has already been thwarted by a kind of internal corruption. Here he's referring to the post-revolutionary corruption of his own country, and therefore he's just as critical of Hispano-America as he is of Anglo-America. However, he argued that Hispano-America has something that Anglo-America does not have, and that is the sort of heroic, idealistic figure of the warrior or the revolutionary, that heroic individual who will continuously struggle to try to make his society better. Rather than producing zombie-like consensus-based robots, Hispano-America produces these martyred individuals who seek to make the world more just. From this panel, then, we go on to the final panel on this wall, the panel referred to as the Gods of the Modern World, and it is the counterpart to the Arrival of Quetzalcoatl panel. In the Arrival of the Quetzalcoatl panel in the west wing of the corridor, we see the Aztec gods arrayed in a kind of pantheon behind the figure of Quetzalcoatl. Here we see an array of academic figures in their academic garb arrayed like modern gods, and they are all presiding like contemporary priests over the birth of dead knowledge. This is represented by the figure of a skeletal woman laid over a pile of gray, steely books as an academic is birthing a fetal skeleton with a mortarboard on his head. This is a reference to a matriculation, however, rather than being a beginning point for students, this is, of course, a reference to the ways in which the academic world tends to perpetuate its own knowledge at the expense of creative innovation. Orozco depicts a series of matriculated fetal skeletons in bell jars, which he has deliberately rendered in the shape of missiles or bullet points. Again, drawing connections throughout this half of the mural between mechanization, industry, warfare, and a kind of corrupt modern world. Now, for many people, this was a very controversial panel. They felt that Orozco was criticizing Dartmouth by attacking institutionalized education. However, this should be understood as a more universal indictment of the academy at large. Orozco had just been in Europe in the 1930s. He had seen firsthand the rise of fascism and the destruction from World War I, and he was very pessimistic about the modern world. This is a world that's about ready to enter into a second world war, and he felt that academics were not doing enough to combat or to critique the contemporary state of the world. So here he's indicting the tendency of institutions of all kinds to be more caught up in the perpetuation of their own authority and power than in putting their resources in the service of social justice or a critique of the modern world. The last two images in this panel, behind the columns here, are the modern equivalents of the ancient migration and the ancient human sacrifice panels. On the left, we see modern human sacrifice, and on the right, a panel he called the modern migration of the spirit. You can see that modern human sacrifice presents us with a representation of the unknown soldier. Here we have the eternal flame burning between the legs of this skeletal being who's completely covered with nationalistic flags and laurel wreaths. Around him, we see a fat politician in a brass band presenting a speech celebrating the sacrifice of soldiers in war, and behind him we see a monument to war, the sort of typical, sort of highly aggressive representation of an armed soldier. Compositionally and thematically, this mural then mirrors the ancient human sacrifice mural. Both are organized along an X-like composition where the sacrificial victim's body is at the center of the composition. And like ancient human sacrifice, where the Aztec ritual sacrifice was being condemned as a barbaric act, Orozco is here condemning modern blood sacrifice in the ritualized problem of modern warfare or nationalistic warfare as its modern equivalent. And like his condemnation of the monumental goddess Coatlicue, over here he condemns the memorialization of this kind of ritual sacrifice in the figures of war monuments. To the left of the panel, modern human sacrifice, you see an image above the doorway called Symbols of Nationalism. Here Orozco has just depicted another junk heap of the regalia associated with the pomp and circumstance of modern nationalism. From this panel, then, we move over into the modern migration of the spirit, where Orozco has taken a series of Christ images and combined them. On the one hand, we have references to the resurrected Christ in this image, we have references to Christ the Pentocrator, or the judge, in this figure, and we have references to the crucified Christ in this figure. This is a post-crucifixion image. Christ's feet have the wounds of his crucifixion, but rather than returning to save humankind or martyring himself for humankind, he has returned to destroy his own cross and to bring about the destruction of the civilization that was begun with Cortez's Catholic conquest. This, too, was a very controversial image and viewed as highly sacrilegious. It's important to know that Orozco was, in fact, a devout Catholic, although he was fairly critical of the church. He uses this as a moral emblem, and he equates the resurrected Christ with the Quetzalcoatl myth. That is, these are both references to prophecy, to prophecies of destruction and renewal. And you can see behind Christ's militarized or sort of militant or strident body, we have a big pile of the destruction representing the civilization that he is about to wipe away. References to Western civilization in the column form, references to a Buddhist sculpture, references to statues of the Venus, images of tanks, and all kinds of weapons piled up in this big junk heap behind him. Likewise, right next to the mural over the doorway here, we have references to chains, guns, and vultures, images of greed and warfare. This is the society that Christ will wipe away, and then the spirit will be released from this modern world so that it can migrate toward a new golden age. This is the culmination of the cycle. However, there is a coda across from the reserve desk. So I'd like to walk toward the reserve desk, and we'll look at the last three images in the Orozco cycle. Here we are in front of a final sequence entitled Modern Industrial Man. This is a coda to the larger cycle. The central image represents a modern worker reclining. He's laid down his hammer and picked up a book. He's shown reading that is engaged in an act of self-edification. Behind him, we see a modern steel frame architectural building under construction. And Orozco mirrors this building under construction with the shape of the worker's body. That is, his shoulder and elbow and long legs mirror the form of this building that recedes nicely and neatly into the background. In this way, he's arguing that, like the building, which is a metaphor for society, the worker himself is under construction. For many people, this image represents a kind of communist iconography because it refers to the worker. However, Orozco was not a communist. Rather, he rejects that kind of social realist iconography or interest in the worker as worker. And instead, he seems to be saying that the human being is not defined by his status as a worker. In fact, he's laid down the emblem of his labor, but rather the individual is defined by their ability to think. And this is signaled in the mural by the fact that he is reading. It's also important to note that this panel refers us to the function of the room in which we stand, which is, of course, a reading room. To the left of the central panel, we see an image of workers standing in a huddle. Above them and in front of them, we see I-beams that seem to be perhaps menacing them. One seems to be about ready to fall on them. Perhaps the others seem to jut up in the foreground and separate the viewer from the figures. To the left of them, we see another pile of machinery, an anvil, pulleys, some kind of industrial architecture in the background. This seems to be a representation of technology overdetermining or menacing humanity. That is, the humans are not engaged in any kind of productive labor. And once again, Orozco is using these cubist devices to create a shallow space and a confused kind of spatial recession. The eye beam that hangs above the worker seems to draw the eye toward the corner, to recede toward the corner, and yet the eye beams that come up in the front of the composition are at odds with that pictorial logic. So this is a confused scene, a scene that seems to represent a bad relationship, one in which technology is menacing human beings. The panel on the other side of the worker seems to represent the opposite. Here we have a building, again, a steel frame building, going up. All the lines of sight of the building recede toward a logical vanishing point. And next to it, we see a group of workers working in unison to participate in the building of this new society. It seems then that Orozco is offering the viewer two alternatives. The new world can either be a continuation of the destruction and the chaos of the modern world, or it can move into a new phase in which humans and industry are reconciled into a productive relationship in which the humans control industry rather than industry controlling the human. So the modern reclining worker seems to be poised between these two possible alternatives, and this is where Orozco leaves us, not with an answer, but with a question about which way the new age will go. Will it continue the chaos of the contemporary world, or will we inaugurate a new golden age, and a golden age in which industry can play a part, but in which industry doesn't overdetermine us? And I just want to recall the ways in which this mural picks up parts of the iconography in the other parts of the mural that we've already looked at. The reclining figure and the use of recessional space picks up that motif from the arrival of Quetzalcoatl and reminds us of the origin of that ancient golden age. Likewise, these references to modern architecture as emblems of a new society pick up that motif referenced in the Hispanic America panel. Whereas in the Hispanic America panel, the modern architecture was an emblem of a new society thwarted or of development stopped. Here, the buildings are still under construction and everything seems to be proceeding apace. So in this way, this panel seeks to unify the theme or the message that's been developed across the cycle. However, unlike his contemporary Diego Rivera, who would have viewed technology and Marxism as the answer for a good future, Orozco doesn't invest in that kind of contemporary politicking or investment in mass politics or political movements. Rather, he once again affirms his faith in the individual as the agent of history, and even more so, the self-edifying individual, not the individual who needs the institution in order to bring him into a state of enlightenment. And I think this as well refers us to the location of the mural. The mural is, of course, located in a reading room at a private college. Orozco very much enjoyed his time at Dartmouth College and was very grateful to his patrons. However, he does seem to have struggled a bit with the conditions of the commission, that he was working for a private institution doing what was understood as a public art. In Mexico, all of the buildings he worked in were truly public spaces, and I think that he may be commenting here on the need to open up the privatized resources of education to the public, and that is why he refers not to a Dartmouth student here, but in fact to a mixed-race worker.
This concludes our tour of the Orozco murals. For additional information, please consult the free brochure available in the reserve corridor, or go to the Hood Museum of Art, or download at the Hood Museum of Art website, which is www.hoodmuseum.dartmouth.edu. Thanks for listening.